Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Right Now Radio on 3CR 855 AM. I'm Kelia Fitzpatrick, your host for the first time this evening, and I'm here with Ben Shockman in the studio. The time is 6 PM and we'll be here with you until 6:30 tonight.
How fun to have a new little voice on Right Now Radio. Welcome, Kelia.
Thank you, Ben.
We're going to have a flood of call from all you listeners out there saying how wonderful they think Kelia is. So,
too kind, Ben. So Right Now Radio is Australia's only dedicated human rights radio program. Each Thursday night from 6 PM here on 3CR, Right Now Radio talks about human rights issues affecting Australians today. We also bring you the latest human rights news from across the country and human rights events happening in Melbourne and across the state. And we do our best to play the best of local human rights inspired music. So on tonight's show, we'll be discussing a campaign by Saudi Arabian women to lift the religious ban on women driving in that country. We'll be hearing from Aziza Abdul Halim, who is the president of the Muslim Women's National Network Australia, on the likely success of the campaign and what it means for Muslim women more generally. But first, we're going to hear the latest news and events. The first story tonight received a lot of media coverage, and it's about the deportation of asylum seekers to Malaysia under the Gillard government's so-called Malaysian solution, suffering a setback after the High Court placed an injunction on the deportations earlier this week. With approximately 100 asylum seekers facing deportation, David Mann, who is the Executive Director of the Refugee and Immigration Legal Centre, sought injunctions on behalf of those asylum seekers facing transfer under the government's refugee swap deal. So Justice Hayne of the High Court made the injunction to extend until the full bench of the full court could consider the lawfulness of the government's policy, which was most likely to be in a special sitting in the week beginning August 22nd.
Yeah, so quite fascinating. I mean, obviously from a legal perspective, it's really interesting, but the politics of it's all fascinating. The government's now got, another 2 weeks to sit and wait, and the media will obviously keep on reporting. So it's quite interesting, both obviously from a legal rights perspective and the rights of asylum seekers to have their processes or their claims processed here. But also just from a broader policy perspective to see how the government's going to respond.
Absolutely, and as well that a federal Labor government is, you know, facing similar legal issues that the Howard government did.
I think indeed, and if you didn't catch the news, I think as late as about 5:30 this afternoon, I think the third boat arrival since the Malaysia solution was announced just arrived at Christmas Island with over 100 people on board. So the boats are still going to come, and we'll see what happens to the Malaysia solution in the coming weeks and months. I mean, the other interesting thing from the High Court's perspective is even though the hearing is obviously going to be in 2 weeks' time, the High Court love to take time issuing judgments, so it may well be another, you know, few weeks, if not months, before the High Court actually issues its judgment. So a big watch this space there. In some other exciting news this week, what else was there? Human rights news. We've had lots about UK riots, haven't we?
Absolutely. It's been dominating the news.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess thinking about it from a human rights perspective, there's lots of different angles. One is a basic freedom of expression type argument and people being able to express their views. But obviously when it goes to the point of property destruction and damage, then that's obviously not acceptable and limitations can be imposed on rights in that particular sense. But another kind of interesting human rights angle, I guess, following some of the analysis or commentary, is the fact that a lot of this has arisen out of particularly unemployed areas, low socioeconomic areas, and looking at basic social and economic rights and people who are either unemployed. Lots of issues of racism, recently arrived migrants are emerging as well. So it's always interesting to look at these, issues that come up and what the human rights angle there is as well.
Yeah, a great YouTube clip has emerged of Nick Clegg last year warning of riots in response to government austerity cuts and government spending cuts. So that was about a year ago and it's now coming back to haunt him.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess it's also interesting to look at what might happen in terms of the Parliament's response. I think I was just hearing that David Cameron's reassembled the British Parliament, or it's about to resit, presumably to look at passing some new laws, specific laws to apply to this circumstance, and whether or not those laws go a little bit over the top in terms of law and order and, you know, an appropriate balance of what human rights are relevant there. That'll be interesting. And of course, as listeners may be familiar, the UK has its own Human Rights Act, which is very similar to our Victorian Charter of Human Rights here. So we'll be watching closely to see whether or not any new legislation gives proper consideration to human rights in its drafting. I guess a couple of other news issues which caught my eye earlier in the week, both relating to the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The first was a report that was obtained, I think, through FOI laws, but it was a report that's been around for about 18 months into the federal government and its spending on programs relating to social and economic aspects of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And the report essentially found that the government hasn't been spending the money in a very cost-effective, cost-efficient way, that all of the programs and outcomes that were expected either haven't been the outcomes that they wanted, or indeed haven't even been measured at all. So the report was quite critical. And what was interesting, I guess, was the fact that the government didn't release that report for well over 18 months, and it was only through freedom of information laws that report was actually released. So a really geeky human rights analysis there is that the right to freedom of expression also includes a right to obtain information, and that's, I guess, what some of the basis for freedom of information laws is there. And that was quite an interesting report to come out. And the very next day, and I think it was entirely coincidental, there was also a report that was released by Amnesty International Australia. It was a report that I understand has been basically been prepared over the last 18 months or 2 years, that looks at Aboriginal homelands in remote areas. So homelands are basically communities where Aboriginal people continue to live on the land and live in their cultural, historic ways. And it essentially found that those communities that did live in their traditional and cultural ways had much higher incidence of health outcomes, educational outcomes. And the concern was expressed that the new Close the Gap policy and the way that funding is intended to operate is that all of these outstation communities are essentially being forced into larger hub towns, they're called, and there are concerns that once a lot of Aboriginal people are forced to move into these larger towns in order to access services, then that's when a lot of the sort of broader social and you know, alcohol issues and things like that actually occur. So a couple of damning reports there, and for people who, I guess, follow the issue a little bit more closely, it cries out, I think, to be one of the responses to be that Aboriginal people need to participate in the way that laws and policies are developed and the way that they apply to them. So lots of work there, I think, for the government to look at the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which it's issued its support for, and get Aboriginal people involved in the way that laws and policies are developed.
Absolutely. We've got two events, Ben, that we want to let our listeners know about. The first is a public lecture being presented by the Caston Centre for Human Rights and the Human Rights Law Centre. And the public lecture is featuring Dr. Angela Ward, who is of the Bar Council in the Law Library of Ireland in Dublin. And the lecture is The Victorian Charter of Fundamental Rights, A Case of Inappropriate Transplants. So that's happening on Thursday, the 18th of August, from 6 till 7:30 at the Monash University Law Chambers, and you can RSVP to the Caston Centre. The next event is on the following Thursday, the 25th of August, and it's being presented by PILCH, the Public Interest Law Clearinghouse. It's from 6:15 onwards at the State Library of Victoria, and that's looking at social change dialogue, Tampa 10 years on. So that dialogue is featuring prominent human rights lawyers Julian Burnside and Debbie Mortimer, and it's being moderated by renowned journalist David Marr.
He's also a renowned journalist as well. It is about 8 minutes past six, and if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Right Now Radio. It's Ben here, and we've got Kelia doing so well on her very first show. It's great to have you with us. We're going to just hear a couple of words from our sponsors.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Welcome back to Right Now Radio on 3CR. Now, Saudi Arabia was left relatively untouched by the uprisings for democracy that swept the Arab world in early 2011. However, this year a smaller but remarkably passionate and dynamic movement has hit the country. It is being referred to as Saudi Arabia's Women's Spring. The initiation of this uprising came from 32-year-old Manal Al-Sharif, a computer security expert and mother of one, who in May this year filmed herself driving in the eastern Saudi city of Khobar and subsequently posted the video on YouTube. These actions were significant because in Saudi Arabia, women are banned from driving. The ban against women driving in the country is not a formal law, and it's not written either, but it is an implied religious edict enforced by the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, also known as Saudi Arabia's Religious Police. Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where such a ban exists. Women rely on taxis, they hire drivers, if they have the means, of course, or they rely on the goodwill of male relatives if they do not. Now, Manal Al-Sharif was arrested on the 21st of May and held for 9 days. The charges laid against her were reportedly for besmirching the kingdom's reputation abroad and stirring up public opinion. Less than 2 weeks later, five further women were arrested for replicating the action protesting the nation's ban on women drivers. Most were detained for a few hours by the religious police I mentioned before, before being released to their male guardians. Several of these women were made to sign a pledge vowing never to drive again in order to secure their release. In late July, prosecutors in the city of Jeddah announced they were going to prosecute a 35-year-old woman for driving. Now, this woman was not specifically involved in the orchestrated campaign that Manal subsequently established, which is called Women to Drive, but this 35-year-old woman claims that she had no alternative to driving as she needed to get to hospital and there was no man to take her there. So Women to Drive, the campaign started by Manal, calls on women to get behind the wheel in large numbers and use social media and the internet to document and publicise the events. Manal has recently publicly stated, "We won't stop until the first Saudi licence is issued to a woman." So her call spread through Facebook and Twitter, and on the 17th of June, an estimated 30 to 50 women got behind the wheel. However, on this day, there were no reports of arrests. Organisers say 10 times that number of women participated in rural areas, where it's reported that women have long defied the ban, which makes a lot of sense. So this is not the first time that something like this has happened. In 1990, another women's driving action took place where 47 protesters were detained and these women subsequently lost their jobs, their passports and a number of other freedoms. Now, the kingdom's response to this most recent women's spring has been somewhat confusing. Now, some suggest that the zero arrests on the 17th of June was due to the king telling police to stand down in the hope that the international attention on the ban in light of these YouTube clips would subside. Senior clerics in the country have warned that women driving would cause them to be harassed in the streets. The Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, the religious police, have issued tip phone numbers where people can report a woman driving. And a counter Facebook campaign has been established by conservatives that calls on women found driving to be beaten up. So these, in light of this kind of context, the actions of these women are incredibly brave in a country where women cannot vote, do not participate in political life, and aren't supposed to leave their houses without the permission of their male guardians. So in light of this, it is surprising to hear that Saudi Arabia has in fact signed and ratified CEDA, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, subject, of course, to two reservations, the first one of which is that in case of contradiction between any term of the convention and the norms of Islamic law, the kingdom is not under obligation to observe the contradictory terms of the convention. So just by way of context, Australia is also a CEDA signatory, and our reservation that we have to the convention relates to a defence force policy which excludes women from combat duties, which is set to be under review soon, which is exciting. To give us insight into the campaign in Saudi Arabia from the perspective of a Muslim woman, Right Now Radio spoke to Aziza Abdul Halim, who is the president of the Muslim Women's National Network Australia. Aziza Abdul Halim was born in Egypt and migrated to Australia in the early 1970s. She's been extensively involved in the education of young Muslim women in both Egypt and Australia, and has been awarded the Order of Australia Medal for her decades of community work in the Australian Muslim community. I spoke with Aziza from Sydney yesterday. Aziza, thank you for joining us here on Right Now Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much. Hi, it's a pleasure.
Now, some are calling this campaign by Saudi women to overturn the ban on them driving the largest women's rights movement in Saudi history. Do you think this is accurate?
It is, because of the internet and all that, but I recall another incident around 1990, around the invasion of the Kuwait time, where a very big group of women went to a car park and demonstrated there, saying, why can't we be allowed to drive cars when our great-grandmothers drove camels and horses? But the police surrounded the area, and they called their men folks, and they came and took them home. And nothing else happened for a while.
Okay, so it could just be a case of 1990 all over again.
That's right. You see, the situation in Saudi Arabia is very complex, right?
Yes.
Because the country is ruled by two very powerful families, the Saudi family and Al-Sheikh family. The Saudi family are the ones supposed to be in government, but the country is ruled by the religious authority of the Al-Sheikh. And they are Wahhabis who implement Sharia in a very, very narrow and limited interpretation that even bypasses what happened in the early stages of Islam.
Okay, so it's very specific then, the situation
specific.
There.
And it is very hard for anyone to go against them because they are the ones who interpret the law and apply the law.
Okay. Well, in light of that, let's look at these events in the context of what's happened in the Arab world earlier this year.
Yes.
Some are calling these events the Women's Spring, so comparing it directly and its significance to that of the uprisings that we've seen in the Arab world.
Mm.
Do you think that's a valid comparison?
Not really, because, you see, what's happening in the Arab world is that the whole population is rising. But in Saudi Arabia, it's only a group of courageous women. And they will be eventually subdued because of the fear of their having, gained a bad name as rebellious, promiscuous, or, imitating foreign women who are not really, examples to be followed. And they will be shamed into being withdrawing probably because of the fact that no one will approach them for marriage and their families will be shamed and so on. But I admire their persistence and I don't think they will give up. But again, at a great cost to themselves personally, unless it is done as a movement, it will not really be effective. If single women keep, raising their voices, then these women will be targeted.
It's interesting as well, Aziza, a lot of the women that are being filmed in their cars and putting them on YouTube, a lot of the people that are filming them are actually their fathers.
Yes.
So maybe that says that it might be...
It's a good sign.
It is a good sign.
You see, again, it takes a lot of courage for anyone to, as I said, to stand up to the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia. And the fact is, a lot of them sort of would allow the women to drive if the driver is in the car with them, because, again, the situation in Saudi Arabia is such that no woman is seen walking by herself in the street. If she must walk in the street, they have to be two together or more. And I think it is also because the reaction of the men to any woman walking by herself would be that this woman is really trying to attract the attention of men. It's a very complicated way of thinking, and it's because, again, of the very strict and narrow and, you know, backward, I'd say, you know, interpretation of family law and the position of women.
Okay. I want to talk about women's involvement in the revolution in Egypt. So women were quite heavily involved, and there were reports of a lot of women taking to cleaning the square as a way of kind of reclaiming it as a citizen's space.
Yeah, women and men and children took part. But you see, this is a revolution of the people. And this is nothing new for Egypt. In 1919, there was a similar revolution against the occupier, the British. And women, even wearing at that time the hijab and the Turkish veil over their faces, took part in the demonstrations. You see, so in Egypt, it's nothing new. Women throughout history took very leading roles.
Yeah.
But in Saudi Arabia, it's a very different situation. Even in Kuwait, there have been some regressive movements. You know, they have been women deans of university, women members of parliament, and then they have taken that away from them a couple of years back, and the women now are again trying to fight back their way into parliament.
Okay. What do you think of will happen to women's involvement in Egypt? Do you think it will last beyond this kind of phase, especially with the Muslim Brotherhood possibly vying for power?
Heaven forbid. I don't think the Muslim Brotherhood should, you know, be allowed to take over. But even if they do, they will have a lot of resistance to any sort of regressive decisions, because women in Egypt have full freedom. And, you know, you wear the hijab, you don't wear it, you wear anything you like, you know, as long as you wear it with respect and people respect your right of choice.
Okay.
So it's very different. And it's different also in countries like Syria, even like Tunisia, where polygamy is outlawed.
Okay, so it's a completely different context.
Mm.
Okay, you mentioned before Sharia law. Now, the ban in Saudi Arabia is enforced by an implied religious edict rather than any type of written law.
Mm.
What do you think this means for the...
It is tradition, and it is tribal tradition. And it is very hard to contend and very hard to push aside, because their weapon is always, you know, this is un-Islamic, this is, you know, breaking away from Islam, from tradition, it's a shame, it's this, it's that. So it really depends on education. And the education system in Saudi Arabia is not really geared towards that kind of freedom, and unless the men themselves realize that their country will not move forward in any way unless the other half of the population is made, you know, is given their rights. I mean, they allow their women to reach the highest degree of education. There are women doctors, there are women teachers and principals, but only where other women are. So you are a principal of a girls' school. You work in a hospital with all women. So there's a complete segregation system in Saudi Arabia, unlike any other country.
Okay. Now, much of the campaign relies, this time around, they're really relying on gaining international media attention as a tool for promoting women's rights in Saudi Arabia.
To some extent, my dear, because even if the national media attacks the what is happening there and try to embarrass the government, they would turn a deaf ear on it, because to them they are righteous, they are doing, you know, what is supposed to be done. Other people are in no position to tell them what to do. This is the attitude. It has to come from inside, from the men of Saudi Arabia themselves, if they become enlightened enough and see the true spirit of Islam, which is equality in every way.
Okay. Kind of building from that, Saudi Arabia is in fact a signatory to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. In light of that, what do you think is the best means for Muslim women to assert their human rights in countries where the government is hostile to those rights?
Well, I mean, they can appeal to human rights organizations for help, but how this help can be given, I don't really know.
Okay. Now, just bringing it back to Australia, a bit more of an abstract question, what do you think this campaign and these events, as well as the Arab Spring uprisings more generally, what do you think that they might mean for Australian Muslim women who are here and some distance away?
Well, they would sympathise, I'm sure, because they all come from countries where they are allowed to drive, and they drive here, so there's no restriction on their freedom here. But they would feel very much, you know, sympathy and, you know, compassion for the women there, unless they are, again, part of the Wahhabi movement and those who believe in the complete segregation and subjugation of women.
Okay. They're all the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you'd like to say, Aziza?
No, except wish them luck and wish them more enlightened men to support them.
And hopefully a win as compared to the 1990 events.
Yes, yes.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye. You're listening to Right Now Radio on Melbourne's own 3CR 855 AM. The time is 6:26. Now, it's difficult to tell if these efforts of by the brave Saudi women will meet a different end to that which met them in 1990. This time, I think there are two key differences. The first time around, Saudi Arabia is now a signatory to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which it signed and ratified in September 2000, so it was not a signatory during the 1990 events. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean that the Saudi government will meet all of the convention's requirements to end discriminations against women, but it does change the landscape for how international pressure is applied by other nations and by human rights groups. For example, in the letter sent to the Saudi government by a group of 14 senators last month, the UN's recommendations that were accepted by Saudi Arabia in 2009, that they abolish all legislation, measures and practices that discriminate against women, including limitations on freedom of movement, the prohibition on women driving, and restricted access by women to work, public places and commercial facilities. That was really strongly relied upon in this letter by US senators. Now, the second point, of course, is the internet and social media. The YouTube videos of Saudi women actively breaking the law have gone viral across the world and have obviously brought with it international attention to their actions. The Women to Drive campaign, its Twitter and Facebook accounts of several thousand followers and linked to YouTube and the specific YouTube videos, as well as supporting campaigns such as Honk for Saudi Women. Having said all this, it was recently discovered in leaked documents by Amnesty International that the Saudi government will soon stretch existing draconian rules regulating the printed press to cover the internet and blog sites and social media. So it's very much watch this space from here on in as a direct result of the campaign.
Indeed. I mean, it's fascinating thinking about the role that social media has played, obviously, in this particular sense here, but even more broadly with the Arab Spring and everything that was going on there, and lots of commentary around the fact that a lot of the, you know, the footage and the solidarity that came from social media meant that what has happened probably wouldn't have happened, or probably not in the same way. So fascinating thinking about that. And I guess also just a bit closer to home, hearing you there, Kilia, talking about ratifying the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And I was reading the other day, even back in the early 90s when there was discussion around introducing the Sex Discrimination Act here in Australia, there was a lot of vehement opposition to that legislation being introduced. And, you know, I guess we're 25, nearly 30 years down the track now from that legislation and seeing the impact that it's had and the long way that we've certainly come, but also the fact that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Absolutely.
Now, 6:29 goes quickly right now, radio, doesn't
incredibly
it?
Incredibly quickly. My first half hour done.
So if you've just tuned in to Right Now Radio, you've missed a great show. What have we been talking about, Kilia?
We've been talking about the campaign by women in Saudi Arabia to get rid of the ban that exists on them currently, the religious ban on them driving in the country. And we've spoken with Aziza Abdul-Halim, who's given us a really interesting perspective from a Muslim woman. Yeah.
So if you've just tuned in and you're like, damn, I missed that, what can you do? You can podcast us, yes. So jump on the 3CR website, www.3cr.com.au. If you're enjoying the show, you want to send us some feedback, perhaps you've got some ideas for some issues that we could cover coming up in the future, feel free, please do drop us an email at radio@rightnow.org.au. If you've loved listening to Keely on her first show, just send us an email and offer your support, or you can give us a call here at the radio station, 94198377.
Excellent.
Thanks for tuning in. Coming up next, we have Mujeres Latin Americas.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.